In the garage of Dr. Frank Conrad, on November 2nd, 1920, the first scheduled pre-advertised radio program in the United States went on the air. Station KDKA was broadcasting returns of the presidential race on the evening of Election Day. From a humble beginning in a Pittsburgh garage to the sumptuous studios of the national radio networks in New York, Chicago, and Hollywood, these are the years we refer to as the Golden Age of Radio.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing it yourself.
Al Kemp, on the air for Griffin.
It's time to shine, shine your shoes anyway.
Tony Home Permanent presents...
And now the host of the Golden Age of Radio, Dick Bertel.
Good evening. My co-host Ed Corcoran is in California this month, where he's gathering material for future programs, and I'm looking forward to his return to hear some really exciting interviews. In the meantime, I want you to listen to something. If you grew up in the 1930s and 40s, you'll recognize that immediately. It's the vibrant sound of a big band on the radio late at night, served over a bed of tinkling glasses and the laughter of an exuberant crowd as it performed live from some exotic place such as Frank Daly's Meadowbrook, the Aragon Ballroom, or the Glen Island Casino. But there was one big band show that was carried on the Columbia Broadcasting System three nights a week in prime time and sponsored by the Liggett and Myers Tobacco Company. It featured the music of Glenn Miller and his orchestra. And for the first 13 weeks of the series, which started in late 1939, the vocal blendings of the popular Andrews Sisters. The show was Glenn Miller's Moonlight Serenade. Let's turn the clock back as we tune in WABC in New York, not the flagship station for the ABC radio network that uses those call letters today. This WABC was at 880 on the dial and was, at the time of this recording, the New York affiliate of the Columbia Broadcasting System. Let's listen.
10 p.m., BULOVA, Bulova Watch Time, WABC, New York.
Chesterfield brings you the Moonlight Serenade. The Cigarette That Satisfies presents America's number one dance band with America's number one swing trio. Glenn Miller and the Andrews Sisters, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, three times every week. And now, here's Glenn Miller.
Good evening, everyone. This is Request Night, and we hope you enjoy the tunes you've asked for. I'm sure you will, if you light up at Chesterfield.
Here's the first one. It's the Andrews Sisters singing, Oh, Johnny, Oh.
Johnny, how you can love. Oh, Johnny, oh, Johnny, heavens above, you make my sad heart jump with joy. And when you're near, I just can't sit still a minute. I'm so, oh, Johnny, oh, Johnny, please tell me, dear, what makes me love you so? You're not handsome, it's true, but when I look at you, I just, oh, Johnny, oh, Johnny, oh. Da 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 da. Took fancy about a certain little lad. Although he's very, very bad, he could be oh so good if he wanted to. Bad or good,
about love and other things. For every girl in town followed him around, just the whole dear thing dancing.
Oh, Johnny!
Oh, Johnny, Johnny, how you can love.
Oh, Johnny!
Oh, Johnny, Johnny, heavens up above, way above, you make my sad heart jump with joy. And when you're near, I just can't sit still another minute.
Oh, Johnny!
Oh, Johnny, Johnny, please tell me, dear, what makes me love you so? You're not handsome, it is true, but when I look at you, I just know, oh, Johnny, 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 my... Johnny, please tell me, dear, what makes me love you so? You're not handsome, it is true, but when I look at you, I just adore Johnny. Oh, Johnny. Oh, Johnny.
The show was sponsored by Chesterfield Cigarettes. The announcers were Paul Douglas and Ed Herlihy. This was the show that would make Tex Beneke, Ray Eberle, Marion Hutton, and the Modernaires musical icons. This was the show that would make Glenn Miller the most popular band leader in America. Glenn understood the power of radio, but he wasn't the first to do so.
My time is your time.
A full decade earlier, bandleader Rudy Vallee had discovered, quite by accident, the value of those late-night band remotes. And remember, in 1928, there were no fees and no sponsors.
These are sustaining. The guy comes over with the outfit, that sets up the box. So now we're on 7 nights a week, from 7 until 3 in the morning. Set 8 hours a night. With the result that when I do the broadcast, let's say 8 to 9 on WABC, I'd say, tune in again at 10 o'clock, we'll be on WOR. When I finish WOR, I said, tune in again at 1 o'clock in the morning, we'll be WMCA. No claimants, no sense to know anything. Well, in about 8 or 9 months, the boys complained one night about 2 o'clock in the morning, the cold sandwiches. I said, boys, in a few weeks, we're going to make so much money, we're going to be such a sensation that just don't complain about the sandwiches. Just take it easy, boys. A song player named Sammy Smith brought Bill McCaffrey over. Bill was at the Keith office in the Palace Theater building, booking the Keith theaters. McCaffrey came over, and he said, I don't see anything of a guy, but Sammy Smith said, give him at least a 3 or 4 weekend at the 81st Street Theater. McCaffrey went back to the Palace Theater, and he said to the girls in the office, Jeff, who the hell? They all went crazy. So he said, I'll give you $400 for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, 2 shows a day at the 81st Street Theater, Keith Theater. I said, fine. We go into the theater. I announce it for 3 weeks before from where we're broadcasting. And of course, the opening day, the lines for miles. You couldn't get near the theater. They pushed the manager out of the lobby. He couldn't understand, not having a radio. He didn't understand how radio works.
There's no time like our time, and no one like you.
In the mid-1930s, a young Benny Goodman also learned how influential radio could be. Benny Goodman Trio jazz pianist Teddy Wilson recalls.
Benny organized a band in 1935 for National Biscuit Company, a long 3-hour radio broadcast, a commercial that went with, I think, Xavier Cugat's band was on it, another band named Kel Murray, and Benny Goodman. In 3 distinct styles of big band music, Benny Goodman representing the jazz, Cugat representing the Latin, and Kel Murray representing what we call the sweet type of band of that day. So 3 distinct type of bands. And so after the radio show, Goodman kept his band together and went on the road with it. And I joined him, that'd be 1935, I joined him in 1936 in Chicago.
None of this was lost on Glenn Miller. According to singer Ray Eberle, Glenn was fully aware of radio's ability to build and promote a band.
Oh, yeah, sure. I think every band leader was. And most of the places then were aware of it was time and publicity that you just couldn't get. Many of the places like Frank Daly's Meadowbrook and Glen Island Casino and places like that used to have some maybe 30 air shots a week. You know, coast-to-coast air programs on all networks. And so bands used to, you probably wouldn't be paid nearly as much as you would doing one-nighters or theaters, but bands used to sacrifice to go into those places to get the airtime, sure.
Ray Eberle sings Indian Summer.
...601 South 16th Street in Clarinda, Iowa, is where Alton Glenn Miller was born on March 1st, 1904, in the upstairs bedroom of the family home. Glenn, who attributed his love for music to his mother's singing, practiced daily on a battered trombone given to him by a local butcher for whom he worked as a boy. At the time of his high school graduation in Fort Morgan, Colorado, he was already on the road with a regional band. By 1925, Glenn had made it to Chicago, where he landed a recording date with the Mound City Blue Blowers. I asked another great band leader of the swing era, Gene Krupa, to explain the definition of a blue blower.
Well, actually, a blue blower was a band who played a kazoo. And it people that are listening now don't know what a kazoo is, you can get the same effect by taking a piece of tissue and putting it over a comb. And this Red Mackenzie used to do that. Now, the Mound City Blue Blowers were quite famous in those days. And as I recall this date, I can name two pretty important guys on it, namely Coleman Hawkins and Glenn Miller.
Yeah? Let's listen. Let's go back about 37 years. Remember it, Gene?
Yes, of course I do, Dick. And what is unique on that record, apart from, of course, Coleman Hawkins' fine work, is the fact that Glenn Miller plays that trombone solo. Now, in all of Glenn's band days, and as famous as he became, he very rarely, if ever, took a solo. He was what is known as a section man.
Yeah.
But on this particular date, he was the only trombone on it, so he had to play a solo.
That same year, Glenn Miller was hired by Ben Pollock and soon made his first recordings with the band. A few years later, Glenn was hired to put together another band that included Bunny Berrigan on trumpet and Ray McKinley on drums. According to Ray, that's where he first met Glenn Miller.
We were both part and parcel of the Smith Ballou Orchestra. Did you ever hear him?
Yes.
Well, Smith had a band, and Glenn and I were with him for several years. He was the only trombone player. And we met there.
It was the height of the Depression, and although the Smith Ballou Band had a number of successful engagements, there were too many long spells without work. The band broke up in 1934. Because Glenn had hired most of the musicians in the band, he felt responsible for them. So he contacted his friends Tommy and Jimmy Dorsey and convinced them to organize their first regular band using his musicians. Glenn played second trombone and became the arranger. The new Dorsey Brothers band was quickly picked up by the Rockwell O'Keefe booking agency. That meant trying to sleep on a bus night after night as it drove from one engagement to the next. Singer Bob Eberle, who joined the Dorsey Brothers band in 1935, recalls what that was like.
We traveled in the bus at that time. We did one-nighters, and I used to kid about one guy. We traveled so much, and we drove our own cars, and we did without sleep, and we ate in beaneries, just like the same as any other band or any traveling group. But still, I remember one guy who was very thin to start off with, and he reached up on the upper shelf to get his bag, and his wristwatch slipped right over his elbow right down to his shoulder because everybody was weighing about 35 pounds, I think, at that time. And we wore cummerbunds that at one time were pretty snug-fitting, and then we had it right down to the last notch. And it's a very wonderful, rewarding feeling to get to a location job, as they said then, maybe at the New Yorker or the Pennsylvania Hotel, and sit down for 3 months. Oh, boy.
That must have been a relief.
Yes, you bet your life. We used to drive our cars, for instance, 300 or 400 miles and play a job and then drive again that night. course, not night after night after night, but I mean, there were several times when I'd find myself driving, I'd pull over the side of the road and fall asleep right at the steering wheel. I'm sure I'm not the only one in the world that ever did that. Mm. Or you see those things in the road, you know, that aren't there after driving without sleep and constantly looking at the road. And it's pretty hard to be a romantic band barrel or baritone or anything else or a good trumpet player after going through physical fatigue like that.
In 1935, the Rockwell O'Keefe Booking Agency welcomed a new client from England, Ray Noble, and they hired Glenn to put together Noble's first band in the States. It met with great success, and Glenn started experimenting with arrangements that eventually would become the famous Glenn Miller sound. The band broke up a year later, and Glenn began formulating plans to start his own band. He soon discovered there was more to running a band than hiring good musicians and coming up with great arrangements. A band leader had to have a good business sense as well. Artie Shaw understood that.
You know, there's an enormous mystique about show business. People seem to be intent on thinking of show business as different from any other business. Well, the common denominator is the word business. Essentially, you are creating a commodity for a market. In jazz, you're creating a music for a mass audience. It's the same thing as a man who creates hot water heaters and tries to sell them to people who are looking for hot water heaters. Well, of course, there are aspects of artistry and show business, but there are also aspects of commerce. The fellow who is so intent on the music he wants to play that he loses contact with the audience that is going to pay for the tickets to come in and hear him, that fellow isn't going to succeed, whether he's right or wrong, whether his music is good or bad. He is guilty of doing the same thing that any businessman does when he indulges himself by ministering to his own tastes rather than to the taste of the audience. Now, on the other hand, a man who ministers only to the taste of the audience is going to lose himself in the process. So there's a fine line you have to tread, and it is sometimes exceedingly fine, where the difference between what you would like to do and what the audience will accept can sometimes be so infinitesimal that if you don't guess right, you're going to be all wrong.
Unfortunately, Glenn didn't guess right. He lost between $18,000 and $30,000 during 1937. The band was beset by problems, from a grueling schedule, a failed recording contract, alcohol abuse by some of the band members, and the very serious illness of Glenn's wife, Helen. The band played its last date on January 2, 1938. But Glenn remained undaunted. In just over 3 months, the new Glenn Miller Band was on the road. Following an exhausting series of one-nighters, the band was booked into a popular New Jersey night spot that was assured of giving the band national radio coverage.
This is Glenn Miller's orchestra playing for you from Frank Daly's Meadowbrook on Route 23, the Newark-Pompton Turnpike in Cedar Grove, New Jersey, just about 15 miles from the city of New York.
From there, it was off to the prestigious Glen Island Casino.
With the cheers and applause of a gala crowd all but drowning out our famous theme song, Moonlight Serenade, we bring you another program of unusual dance music as played for you by one of America's ace arrangers and foremost exponent of the swing trombone, Glenn Miller. This music comes to you as usual from the Glen Island Casino, Westchester's smart rendezvous, just off the Shore Road at New Rochelle, New York, where you can dine and dance at the water's edge of Long Island Sound.
The band had suddenly become young America's favorite. Glenn was signed up by Victor Records, and shortly thereafter, for a flat fee of $175, he recorded a tune which would come to define the band whenever and wherever it performed, In the Mood.
Hey!
The band's appeal was due not only to the quality of the music, but to the strictness of the discipline that Glenn Miller imposed on his musicians. Singer Ray Eberly explains.
I remember one time, this is, for instance, the greatest thing you could do in those days was, the height of everything was the Paramount Theater in New York City. And every orchestra that played there had the same setup. It would be like a 45-minute show or a 43-minute show with maybe two acts beside the orchestra. The band would play a couple of tunes, then an act would come on, and the band would play for the act, and so on and so forth through the thing. So came our time. I think it was the second time that we went in the Paramount, and Glenn informed the people that he wanted the act's music 2 weeks before we opened, because he said he wanted the orchestra to memorize it. He said, because there are going to be no music stands on the stage. He said, the uniform will be with white shoes, he said, and I want everybody in the theater to see your white shoes. He said, and they better be white. Everybody better have haircuts. He used to say to me, hey, Jim, your ears are peaking. He used to call me Jim when I'd need a haircut. So I'd know that that meant that I better go get it, or if I didn't, he'd tell me that I'd have an upper berth back to Hoosick Falls. That's where I was born. I'm sorry about that, but that's the way it is.
After closing at the Glen Island Casino, the band headed out for a series of theater dates where they began to break attendance record after record.
The National Broadcasting Company invites you to listen to Glenn Miller's music. Moonlight Serenade, Glenn Miller's own famous creation, identifies once more the nation's new sensation in music, the Moonlight Serenaders. Glenn Miller, one of America's ace arrangers and foremost exponent of swing trombone, presented from Radio Center, WFBR, Baltimore.
Suddenly it seemed that all America was into the groove of swing. Singer Bob Eberly, who was beginning to generate hit after hit with Helen O'Connell and the Jimmy Dorsey Band, recalls that era.
I think that the whole warm period then was something that probably will never be seen again, because I guess those things don't happen more than once. For instance, in New York City area, for instance, at the Paramount Theater, Frank Sinatra was there with Tommy Dorsey's band, and we were at the Strand Theater, and then maybe Glenn Miller would come in with his band the next week at the Capitol or one of the other hotels in town, and everybody was so enthused about seeing the big bands, and the music on the radio at that time was accepted. And the records were accepted, and it seemed like everything else around it was wholesome.
Glenn, as thousands cheer from coast to coast, and what look to be thousands in this room tonight, you can be sure that your fans will be faithful to you for a long time to come, and to Ray, as he sings now, faithful to you.
It was at this time that the band caught the attention of Liggett and Myers. They had been sponsoring programs featuring Paul Whiteman and his orchestra and Fred Waring's Pennsylvanians, which attracted older listeners. Here was an opportunity to introduce a younger audience to its Chesterfield brand of cigarettes. To protect themselves against the risk of relying solely on a still relatively unproven band, the tobacco company also signed up the famous Andrews Sisters as insurance. 2 days after Christmas, December 27th, 1939, the new Chesterfield program hit the air.
Now our one and only Andrews Sisters as they swing the South American way.
Have you ever kissed in the moonlight in the grand and glorious is like a dream of love. The Latin stream of love is in their veins. They'll buy a jewel for you, or fight a duel for you, or drive a mule for you across the plain. Hi-yi, hi-yi, there is melody in their music. While the gods shall sing it, come on and swing it the South American way. La-da-da-da-da. Hi-yi, hi-yi, have you ever danced in the tropics? Where they fill the pool with the gauchos full of that South American way. Hi-yi, hi-yi, could you have ever kissed in the moonlight? If you've never kissed a boy, what you've missed in that South American way. The Latin scheme of love is like a dream of love. It's like a stream of love that's in the veins. They'll buy a jewel for you, or fight a duel for you, or drive a mule for you across the plain. Hi-yi, hi-yi, there's melody in their music. While the gauchos sing it, come on and swing it the South American way. The Latin stream of love is like a dream of love. The Latin stream of love is in their veins. They'll buy a jewel for you, or fight a duel for you, or drive a mule for you across the plains. Hi, 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 there is melody in their music. While the gauchos sing it, come on and swing it the South American way. They will drive a mule across the plains, even if it snows or rains. The South American way.
Fortunately for us today, Glenn had the programs recorded off the air for reference purposes. In those days, private recording companies employed banks of turntables, each connected by wire to the four networks. For a fee, they would record your show. Rudy Valley, for instance, had a standing order to record everything he did, even his rehearsals.
Who's recording the Rudy Valley Dream Shampoo Show?
I am, on table six.
They're ready to go. They're flashing you.
All right, everybody. Quiet, please. Quiet. This is Valley in Studio A. Stand by to take off our rehearsal. All set? Here we go. Stopwatch.
As the stopwatch ticked off the seconds, the cutting needle of the recording machine began the process of engraving into a blank disc a permanent record of everything that followed.
Here they are, the Andrews sisters, Laverne, Patty, and Maxine, with that swell tune, Say CC.
In Spain they say si, si. In France you hear oui, oui. Every little Dutch girl says ya, ya. Every little Russian says da, da. But sweetheart, tell me why. No matter how I try, you won't listen to my plea. Won't say yes in any language to me. When will you say, see, see? Every little Dutch girl says, ya, 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 ya. Every little Russian says, da, da. But sweetheart, oh, why won't you tell me why? No matter how much I try, please tell me why. Won't you listen to my plea? Won't say yes in any language to me. Oh, when you say CC, say CC.
Thank you.
you could only say see see wee wee yeah yeah da 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 da. Then all my life would be a song. Nothing could go wrong, go wrong, go wrong. If you give in, I'll win. I won't give up, darling. If you give in, I must hear you say see see. Oh, won't you listen to my plea? Please say yes in any language to me. Won't you say see see, say see see.
Unfortunately, the relationship with the Andrews sisters lasted only 13 weeks. It seems they refused to make even minimal cuts in their numbers, forcing the band to make all the concessions. Besides, the sisters had stopped talking to each other, making it almost impossible to determine what it was they were going to sing. Their contract was not renewed, and Glenn Miller was given the chance to prove he and the band had what it took.
And now we're off with the Little Brown Jug.
Hey! Hey, jump, jump! Hey, jump, jump!
Band singer Paula Kelly, who had worked with several orchestras early in her career, including Dick Stabile, Artie Shaw, and Al Donahue, looked out the window at the passing landscape as her train headed for sunny California. She was to join the band in Hollywood, where filming was scheduled to begin on Glenn's first movie, Sun Valley Serenade.
Howdy, folks, let's go for a ride. Get your favorite one to sit by your side.
Cuddle up in a sleigh, giddy-up, Nellie Gray, and away we go. While you listen to the sleigh bells ring, yodeling to your baby.
You'll feel nice and warm no matter how cold it may be. Take a look at little Jack and Jill. They ski down a hill, that's a snowplow turn. And look, there's a spill on the hill. When you're down, it's a thrill to go up again. Everybody ought to learn to ski, for that is how we first met. We were that Jack and Jill that came down a hill. When I looked at you, my heart took a spill on a hill. It's a thrill that I can't forget. It happened in Sun Valley, not so very long ago. There were sunbeams in the snow, and a twinkle in your eye. I remember, oh so clearly, that you nearly passed me by. Then it happened in Sun Valley, when you slipped and fell, and so did I.
Filming Sun Valley Serenade required that the Chesterfield show originate on the West Coast. Paula remembers those shows vividly.
I sure do. I remember very, very well. Many of them, as a matter of fact, some of them from the Lux Radio Theater in Hollywood. At that point, we were getting up for a 5 o'clock makeup call in the morning, making Sun Valley Serenade. We were reporting in the evening at the Palladium to do our chores there for the dancing public. And in between times, we did the Chesterfield show. So if we weren't doing something at 20th Century Fox, we were rehearsing at the studio, Lux Radio Theater, or we were at the Palladium doing our thing.
Now every year we go back, and then we recall that fall and that moment when we were there on a hill. So we both take a spill, and we're Jack and Jill. Again, again.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced. The attack also was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu.
The following day, Monday, December 8th, Glenn Miller and the band would go into the studio for another recording session, this time to record Moonlight Cocktail. The country was at war. Yet for a while at least, life went on. The band headed back to Hollywood in March 1942 for their second movie for 20th Century Fox, Orchestra Wives. They were joined by George Montgomery, Ann Rutherford, Carol Landis, and Cesar Romero. Marion Hutton returned to the band, and together with Tex Beneke and the Modern Airs, she filmed this Glenn Miller classic.
Hi there, Tex, how's your new romance? The one you met at the campus dance.
Wait until you see her, you'll agree. My hometown gal's the only one for me. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I got a gal
in Kalamazoo.
Don't wanna boast, but I know she's the toast
of Kalamazoo, zoo, 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 zoo.
Years have gone by,
my, how she grew.
I liked her looks when I carried her books
in Kalamazoo, zoo, 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 zoo.
I'm gonna send a wire, hopping on a flyer,
leaving today.
Am I dreaming? I can hear her screaming.
Hiya, Mr. Jackson, everything's okay. A-L-A-M-A-C-O. Oh, what a gal, a real pipperoo.
I'll make my bid for that freckle-faced kid I'm hurrying to.
I'm going to Michigan to see the sweetest gal
in Kalamazoo.
Kalamazoo.
that freckle-faced kid I'm hurrying to.
We're going to Michigan to see my sweetest gal in Kalamazoo.
By now, the Miller Band's popularity was at an all-time high, and yet the seeds of change were already being sown. Big band singers were no longer content to get a mere mention on the label. They wanted to become stars and record on their own. So Joe Stafford left Tommy Dorsey to record for Capitol, Dick Hames signed with Decca, and of course, Frank Sinatra left the Dorsey Band under stormy circumstances to record for Columbia. Soon, in theaters across the country, singers were getting equal billing with the bands. Big band leader Duke Ellington recalls one of Frank Sinatra's first stage appearances as a solo performer.
Yes, that was 1942 here in Hartford at the State Theater. Was it the State? Down the hill there? Yeah, I'll never forget, we were working there and Sinatra was the extra added attraction. And that's when I started writing Black, Brown, and Beige, when the picture was on. And they had a picture there called The Cat. And I was writing music and this cat started creeping across the street, creeping in my direction. And Black, Brown, and Beige ended right in the middle of something or other, I don't know what. Very funny bit.
And just as that cat crept across the screen, the shadow of war crept slowly across the Pacific to islands most of us had never heard of before. Glenn wanted to get involved, to somehow take his music to the boys overseas. On September 10th, 1942, he got his wish when he received an appointment as captain in the U.S. Army. Ray Eberle recalls how Glenn broke the news to the members of the band.
He came through the bus one night after one of the jobs, or before one of the jobs, and said, this thing is getting pretty strong, this war thing. He said, now, he had a letter from Washington. He said, they wanted him to go in, and they were going to commission him as a captain. And any of the members of the band that wanted to go in, why, they could go in and, as sergeants or whatever. And so he walked through the band and got many of the fellas that were single. He asked me, and I at the time was married, and I had two children. And I reneged. I said, no, I'll... You know, if it gets real bad and they need me, of course I'll go and settle the whole thing.
The mailman's been in again and he brought a pile of requests for Farewell Blues. And here it is, played by Glenn Miller.
Two weeks later, the band broadcast its last Chesterfield show from the stage of the Central Theater in Passaic, New Jersey. To a nation by now used to tears, it was a heart-rending farewell. Not only was America saying goodbye to an idol, but without realizing it at the time, it was also saying goodbye to an era.
Our best until we see you again, and in the meantime, just make that next pack Chesterfields. Today is better tasting, cooler smoking, definitely milder cigarettes. Paul Douglas speaking. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Unfortunately, Glenn Miller would never return to the Chesterfield bandstand. A steady rain was falling over Britain on December 15, 1944, and it was cold and foggy. Nevertheless, Major Glenn Miller, anxious to begin preparations for the band's trip to the continent, climbed into a single-engine C-64 Norseman that would fly him across the English Channel to Paris. The plane took off with the most popular band leader in America aboard and was never heard from again. My thanks to Rudy Valley, Teddy Wilson, Bob and Ray Eberly, Gene Krupa, Ray McKinley, Artie Shaw, Paula Kelly, and Duke Ellington for their invaluable recollections of that time and the man who defined the big band era. Portions of the music for this program were provided by jazz record collector Jack Gookin of East Windsor, Connecticut. And now until next time, for co-host Ed Corcoran, this is Dick Bertel. Good night.
The Golden Age of Radio with Dick Bertel was produced and edited by Bob Schirago. This is Bill Hansen speaking.
Pepper Young's Family. The story of your friends, the Youngs, is brought to you by Kame, the mild beauty soap for a smoother, softer complexion.
Rinse-o white and rinse-o bright.
Broadcasting from New York City, the Lucky Strike program, starring Jack Benny with Mary Livingston, Phil Harris, Rochester, Dennis Day.